In Job 26, we've come to an important juncture in this book. If you've been with us, you know that what we have here is Job first speaks, and then Eliphaz, and then Job, and then Bildad, and then Job, and then Zophar, and then Job. And that process goes along for three cycles. Only when we get to the third cycle in this pattern here, what happens is Bildad speaks just briefly, and then Job speaks. This gets taken in two different ways. So far, there's a question of whether we hear any more from him or not. Some believe that what happens here, you notice Job 25 is very short. Six short verses when Bildad speaks. And some believe that at this point in the book, Job has had all he can take of his friend's repetitious platitudes that we've been observing. And he interrupts. Others believe that what happens is that Bildad has already said what he knows to say, and his point with this one this time is driven home by making the point in verse 6 that Job is a man who is only a maggot in God's eyes, or a worm in God's eyes. Verse 6 there says, and that Bildad has driven his point home in the brevity of what he said, and therefore Job responds. We'll think about how to take that as we go along. What's clear to start with, though, is that we are at an important point in this book with this class this morning. Now, look with me carefully at the first two verses. We start the first three verses at chapter 26. Becky, would you read for us, please?
Then Job responded, "What a help you are to the weak! How you have saved the arm without strength! What counsel you have given to one without wisdom! What helpful insight you have abundantly provided!"
All right, now I'd like you to notice the terms that Job uses here. Obviously, he's speaking somewhat sarcastically, and this is why some think that he cuts Bildad off. And look at the terms that he uses. I think that you can see what Job believed a friend ought to mean when you're in the furnace of affliction like this. Notice the terms, verse 2, help for the weak, or help for the one who has no power. And help here in the sense of, the kind of thing I saw this morning in getting Kay's basket of casseroles in here. Somebody to pick up the end of it and help carry the load. That's what he's talking about. Help here, not in explaining and so forth only, but helping the person who is weak. And the last part of verse 2, saving the man who has no strength. Saving, and the word saving, we often use it only in terms of forgiveness of sin, but in the Bible it's used in the sense of deliverance or rescue, and Job needed that kind of thing for them. Counsel for the person who has no wisdom. The one who can't figure things out and who can't decide the best thing to do in the middle of that. And then, Becky, the last phrase in verse 3, how did that version say it?
What helpful insight you have abundantly provided.
All right, helpful insight. This is translated in other versions, how you plentifully declared, and here's the way I would take it, explaining things. To him. He believes that doing this is what gets them in the trouble, but there's the question. Before I say something to a person who is hurting or a person who is dealing with pain or loss, I want to think, will this help him carry the load? Will this rescue him from his plight? Will it help him look for wisdom in his own life? And will it offer any helpful insight into how to proceed? Now, Job is saying this in a tone of voice that says, you fellows have not done any of that for me. Your words have missed the point all the way around. And something interesting happens in verse 4. Look at it. Tim, verse 4.
To whom you have uttered words, and whose spirit was expressed through you.
All right. It's in the form of a question, in the ESV at least, and I think you take it this way. What he wants to know is, whose breath has come through you in all of this activity? Who has helped you? Whose help have you been drawing? Now, the interesting thing to me about it is that the word for inspiration in the New Testament is God breathed. And Job is asking now, whose breath has come out from you? He's asking them to investigate the source of the advice that they're giving him. And the reason that's interesting in this book is that remember, we suggested that the enemy is using Job's friends to try to move Job away from his integrity and to try to undermine his confidence in God. So Job's laid his finger here on an important point. Whose breath is coming through the counsel and advice that he's given? Now, right here in this chapter, and it's a wonderful chapter, we won't look at every verse of it, but right here, Job turns his attention to the greatness and the awesomeness of God. His friends have been telling him that Bildad, for example, remember chapter 25, verse 4, how then can man be right in the sight of God? In other words, Job, you need to think about how great God is, and you need to quit saying that you are right before him and that if you could draw near to him, he'd hear your cause and all that kind of thing. Job is going to say in this section, the question that he's struggling with is not God's greatness. What he's struggling with is God's nearness. And Job is about to show that he has a more expansive view of the sovereignty of God and the almighty part of God's nature than his friends have. Some of the phrases he uses are really intriguing to me. And I wonder how man would know some of these things if he lived in the patriarchal age, as we believe Job did. Let me just call your attention to some of them. Verse 6, Sheol and Abaddon are uncovered and open before God. Both of those are terms for the grave or the hidden world. They would be parallel to what the New Testament would call Hades, I believe. And those realms which are unseen to us are open and uncovered before God. I remember Hebrews 4:13. All things are naked and open. They're laid open before him, before the eyes of him with whom we have to do. All right, verse 7. He stretches out the north over the void and hangs the earth on nothing. Isn't that an interesting thing? In an age maybe when people after him thought Atlas held it up, how did Job know that God hangs the earth on nothing?
Still thought the earth was flat.
Yeah, that people still thought that. There's an interesting part of that even that comes up here. Verse 8, he binds up the waters in the thick clouds. And the cloud is not split open under them. That's an interesting one. How does the cloud hold all that water that it dumps on us up there? Job
and water,
all right, they carry heavy water to us. They do. Job is, you can see that Job is a man who has looked at the world around him and been impressed with it. But you can also see that he has greater insight into some of these things than an ordinary fellow would, or the people of his day normally are thought to have. All right, verse 9, he covers the face of the, how do your versions translate that, verse 9?
Full moon.
Full moon, some do. Some translate it throne. The reason for that is that the Hebrew words for full moon and throne sound just alike when they're spoken. Now, when the vowel points are put on them are not just alike, but they sound just alike. And so either way it would be true. I kind of think the full moon fits better because it's mentioning the thick clouds both before and after it. And the idea would be Job looking up here at the full moon. Did you see the moon last night? I don't know if it was full, but it was bright and beautiful. All right. Look at verse 10 now. He has inscribed a circle on the face of the water, of the waters. When I look at that, I think of the horizons. I've seen the ocean before and standing there and looked out at the horizon and all that water just looked like it's standing there. But there is a circle. And if you extend this, he would be talking about the circle of the earth. Again, when people, ordinary people, thought the earth was flat. The verse 11, and by the way, mentions the boundary toward between light and darkness. Job didn't know about the international date line, but there's a boundary between them. And then there's the pillars of heaven that tremble. I think maybe he's talking about the thunder. By his power, he rules over the sea. Think about the thundering of the sea against the shore. And then by his understanding, he shattered Rahab. I tried to do some investigating about the Rahab here, and I found out that in Isaiah 30 and verse 7, Rahab is another name for Egypt. And that what this is saying here then would be that God has the power just to bring down the mightiest king or the mightiest nation or military power. Then verse 13, by his wind the heavens are made fair. What's he talking about? Well, the wind that comes up and blows the clouds on over the way out of the way and provides for a beautiful day. All right, now he has Job describes the majesty of God there. I think that'd be the right way to say it. The majesty of God, and then verse 14. It's a wonderful verse that sums this up. Brother Feeney, would you mind to read the last verse of Job 26?
No, these are parts of his ways, but how little a portion is heard of him. But the thunder of his power, who can understand?
All right, now all these wonderful things that he's just mentioned are just a portion of God's ways, and a small portion of God's ways. And in fact, some of the versions translated, I think, the outskirts of his ways.
Fringes.
The fringes of his ways. All right. These, and we just hear a small whisper of God, Job says. What if we heard that this is just a whisper, what would the thunder be like? The thunder of God's power. So you put all that together. What does it have to do with the discussion in this book? When Job's friends are lecturing him about how great God is, they are talking to a man who sees God's greatness in an even more vivid terms than they do. That's not the problem. The problem is that if God is that great, then why is this happening to Job? See? And that's the part of it that's a struggle. Now, look at chapter 27, verses 1 through 6. Job at this point lays his finger sort of at the point I was getting at there. Here he contrasts. A lot of the scholars will say we ought to imagine a great silence at the end of Job 26, expecting another friend to speak or somebody to say something, and nobody does. So then Job again took up his discourse.
Is that why they divided it into a chapter there?
Maybe. The chapters are divided generally by the then Job answered or then the other one responded or some such thing as that. Probably it is here too. But the important thing, look at verse 2 through 6. Job still maintains his integrity here. Brendan, read for us.
As God lives, who has taken away my right, and the Almighty who has embittered my soul. For as long as life is in me, the breath of God is in my nostrils. My lips certainly will not speak unjustly, nor my tongue utter deceit. Far be it from me that I should declare you right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. I will hold fast my righteousness and will not let it go. My heart does not reproach any of my days.
All right, now Job uses the Almighty God as witness to an oath that he makes to his friends in this passage. The key thing to his friends is, in verse 5, I'm not going to say that you are right. In other words, if they were right, what would be the point of that to Job? If Job's friends were right, what would it mean to him? All right, this had all happened to him because God was punishing him for some wickedness in his life, and that the answer to Job's pain and loss would be repentance and him correcting the wrong that he had done. Job, however, says, and this has been his point through the book, till I die, I will not, what? I won't give up my integrity. I won't put away my integrity. This is the same thing that he held fast to in the beginning. Now, notice what he says about God. God's Almighty, verse 1. He lives, verse 1 also. God has given him the breath in his own nostrils, verse 3. But what does he say about God in verse 2 there? I ascribed some things to verse 1 that I meant verse 2.
My soul bitter.
All right. God has at the beginning, as God lives, who has
taken away my right.
What is Job claiming? This is where Job, to me, where Job gets closest to saying what is sinful. Job is saying, I still hold fast my integrity, and here's what he's saying. God is almighty. God lives and is almighty. Job is saying, I'm not going to say my friends are not right, or right, rather. I can't say that my friends are right. But he does say, God has taken away my right.
My person says justice, and to me that's
the same idea that I'm getting at here, I think. And I'm using the word right because to let you see that what Job is doing is responding to what he understands his friends have said. They were saying that Job was not in the right. Job was saying, I am in the right. God has taken away my right. Now, I'm not going to accuse Job of sinning here. I read these as the words of a hurting man. But I do think that they illustrate that Job has a misunderstanding about God's sovereignty too, at least at this point. Job believes that what is happening to him is not fair, but that it has been caused by God. Okay. And notice verse 6 then, I hold fast my righteousness and will not let it go. My heart does not reproach me for any of my days. Job is saying, I have a clear conscience. I may have a confused mind, and I may have a body that is suffering terribly, but I have a clear conscience, even after all of this back and forth with his friends. Now, any comment that you guys want to raise at this point about how Job is feeling, and any observation about how this affects the drama of this book, Becky?
Do you think it would make any difference if Job thought of it as God is doing this, or that God is letting Satan do this? I mean, I see
what you're saying, and I do think it might have made some difference in the sense that a part of the pressure that has been put on Job by the enemy through Job's friends is that you have caused this. This is your fault, Job. And I think that the mental and spiritual agony that him having to question all of the things that he had believed in made the physical and social agony that he's enduring even worse. I still think that a man, even if he knows, like we know, that sometimes God, though he doesn't cause things, in his providence he allows things to happen, and then he takes all of those things and strengthens his people through it and brings his cause, promotes the cause of his kingdom in the world. We know that the Bible teaches that, but don't we still feel like sometimes that things are happening to us that are not fair? And don't we feel like sometimes that God is not near? I think we do. That's a part of the struggle of faith, apparently. Ed?
As we generally talk to people, maybe they may be unbelieving people or they may be believing. Either way, a lot of times they will take this attitude that if God allows all these bad things to happen to people, why should I want to serve a God like that? Mm-hmm. And I think that we're getting very close to some of this in the lesson.
I think we are too. And the point that I tried to suggest to start this, the first two lessons of this series, is the idea that Job is not trying to explain everything about why good people suffer, but this book is saying that God is worth serving anyway, no matter what. That gets to be an important part of the study here, I think. All right, anybody else?
Well, I think, Bill, it's a battle for us as humans, a continuous battle to deal with pain, suffering, loss, all those things that Job has been through. These lessons through Job are just teaching us to keep on keeping on.
I think also that God is with us even when sometimes we're afraid he isn't. I think that part is here too. Yeah. Anybody else? All right, now, at verse 7 of chapter 27, a point is reached in the book that has a whole lot of stuff written about it and sometimes appears to be confusing. Because Job says, "Let my enemy be as the wicked, and let him who rises up against me be as the righteous." That seems to be, what's he mean by that? What is the hope of the godless when God cuts him off and when God takes away his life? Verse 11, "I will teach you concerning the hand of God what is with the Almighty. I will not conceal." Those kinds of statements sound more like Job's friends than they sound like Job. Now, for example, look at verse 13 and 14. "This is the portion of a wicked man with God, and the heritage that oppressors receive from the Almighty. If his children are multiplied, it is for the sword, and his descendants have not enough bread." All right. Now, I'd like you to notice back a few chapters with me. Look back to chapter 21 and verse 11. One example of this. This is Job's response. Well, it'll make more sense if I ask you to back up to chapter 20 first. And in chapter 20, I'd like you to notice that that Zophar, the third friend of Job, argued with Job based on what happens to the wicked in their life. He says that the rejoicing of the wicked is short and the joy of the godless is but for a moment. Verse 5 talks about how the wicked may have children and he may appear to be prospering and so forth, and that suddenly God takes them away. Look at the last two verses of chapter 20, with Zophar's words. The possessions of his house will be carried away and dragged off in the day of his wrath, that is, of God's wrath. This is the wicked man's portion from God, and the heritage decreed for him by God. Now, with your finger at the place where we were in chapter 27, look at verse 13 again. This is the portion of the wicked man with God and the heritage that oppressors receive from the Almighty. Do you see the similarity in the two statements? All right. Look at chapter 21 now and verse 11. This is Job talking about the wicked in response to what Zophar has just said. Job said the wicked reach, he knows the wicked have lived and reached old age and grown mighty in power. Verse 8 says their offspring are established in their presence and their descendants before their eyes. Their houses are safe from fear, and no rod of God is upon them. Verse 11, they send out their little boys like a flock, and their children dance. All right, now back over to 27, 13, and 14 again. Here, verse 13 says, this is the portion of a wicked man with God. Verse 14 says, if his children are multiplied, it is for the sword, and his descendants have not enough bread. Now, do the statements in 27 sound more like Zophar or Job? It's hard to compare verses when I'm split back and forth like that. All right,
they're both basically saying the same thing, but from a different perspective.
Okay. What I notice when I try to read the suggestions that have been made about how to handle this passage, there are two main possibilities. One is that Zophar has interrupted here. When Job maintains his righteousness and his integrity and so forth, one possibility is that Zophar jumps in the middle of it, and we're not told that in the text. There are some who believe there is a break here, and chapter 27, verses 11 through 23, is actually Zophar's third speech. It's possible, I suppose. If it is, it would be the only time in this book when someone speaks without us being told who it is. And so the other possibility is that at this point, Job has used his friends' own explanations against them. And that Job is hoping, notice very carefully chapter 27 and verse 11, I will teach you concerning the hand of the Almighty, concerning the hand of God, what is with the Almighty I'll not conceal. Behold, all of you have seen it yourselves. You is plural there. Why then have you become vain altogether? And the suggestion is that what's happening is that Job is wishing upon his friends their own explanations. That seems to me to be the better possibility. The better explanation of this text here. And what Job would be saying, if that's the case, is that his friends need to realize that if they are standing by their explanations toward him, then they are either saying that they themselves, all three of them, are going to live all of their lives without ever having any heartbreaking calamity happen to them that might mean God's displeased with them, or they are subjecting themselves to sitting on the ash heap themselves someday and having to live with their own explanations. Neither course has any comfort to it, of course. And I think that might be the point that Job is making. The reason I think that Job is the speaker there still comes at the end of verse, at the end of chapter 31. Notice it says the words of Job are ended. Does everybody see that? So at the beginning of 27, Job again took up his discourse and said, and then at the end of 31, the words of Job are ended. Job is would appear to me to be the speaker through this whole section. Now,
in chapter 29, it says Job further continues his discourse.
Yes, thanks, John. Chapter 29, verse 1 does say that. All right. I know the time is almost away from us, but I'd like to tie in chapter 28 as quickly as I can here with this thought. Notice that Job has said to his friends, how you have counseled him who has no wisdom. And chapter 28 is an amazing poem about the value of wisdom and where wisdom is to be found. The key terms, the key statements in Job 28 are in verse 12. Everybody look. But where shall wisdom be found, and where is the place of understanding? And then verse 20, from where then does wisdom come, and where is the place of understanding? Why is Job talking? This is what you'll find about chapter 28. Why does such a poem as this come up in the middle of this book, where there are conversations back and forth about why Job has endured these calamities? Can you see any reason why this would come up here? All right. What is wisdom?
Use of knowledge.
All right, so the use of knowledge. So I'll quickly define it this way. Discerning the proper application of knowledge. For now, I'll use that that idea. You could look at 1 Kings 3 and get an idea of why we would say that. Now, in this book, why is that question such a huge question?
The lack of knowledge.
All right. There are a lot of things that people know. Sometimes Job will say, don't you think I know that too? That type thing. But the question is, what is the proper way in which Job should handle the loss that he's been through? What is the proper course for Job to take in the middle of this thing? Was it out of place for Job to speak up and say the things he did in Job chapter 3, for example? That becomes the question that's at stake here. Job is saying, my friends have not given me any counsel for my lack of wisdom in this situation. Job has wisdom enough to know that what they're saying is not right in his case. And so, having gone through all of that, Job still holds fast his integrity, and what he wonders here is where, if and when and where any wisdom is going to be found that will apply in this situation or guide him in the right way. Just as a quick survey, what Job says in chapter 28, notice verse 1, there's a mind that men have learned how to search out the earth and to mine silver and gold and copper and so forth from deep under the earth. They've learned how to sink shafts and go to the farthest and darkest limits in search of precious things, verses 1 through 4. Men have learned how to cultivate the earth so that bread can be brought forth out of it, verses 5 and following. Men have been able to deal with the animal kingdom and learn where animals live and how animal life works and so forth, verses 6 and 7. And even in the world of nature and plants, verses 9 through 11, men have learned things about that. But where is the great shortcoming of mankind? According to Job, verse 12. We know how to mine precious ore. We know how to grow crops. We know how to manage, to engage in animal husbandry. But what we don't know is how to live. That's Job's point in this. Yeah, look at verses 12 and immediately following there. But where shall wisdom be found, and where is the place of understanding? Man does not know its worth, and it is not found in the land of the living. You see that, Job 28, verses 11 and 12. Then Job describes the precious value of wisdom. He says in verse 18, the end of the verse, the price of wisdom is above pearls. That's like the book of Proverbs, Proverbs 1:7, Proverbs 9:10, Proverbs 16 says the same thing. Wisdom is the main thing. Therefore, get wisdom. That's the idea. But the question still remains. Even if you know the value of wisdom, and you still don't have it and don't know where to get it, you're no better off. So Job says, verse 20, from where then does wisdom come, and where is the place of understanding? It's hidden from the eyes of all living and concealed from the birds of the air. All right? Now, that's the key phrase. It's hidden from the eyes of all living. We learned in chapter 26 that Sheol and Abaddon have no covering before God. Here it says that Sheol and Abaddon say, we've heard a rumor of it, of wisdom, verse 22. And then verse 23, there's the declaration. Travis, can you read 23 for us, 23:24?
God understands the way to it, and he knows
it. The it is wisdom now here.
And he knows it place, where he looks to the end of the earth, sees everything under the heavens.
All right. In the New Testament, James says, if any man lacks wisdom, let him ask God. And here the idea Job is saying, and Job is saying this to his friends, wisdom doesn't lie with you. Wisdom lies with God. And you ought to ask when you're trying to give help or trying to save or trying to counsel, you ought to ask where you're getting the advice that you're disseminating here. And so this is still tied with chapter 26, I think. And it talks about some of the ways in which God used wisdom and his creation. And then come to verse 28 of Job 28. What does it say, Travis?
And he said to man, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to turn away from evil is understanding.
All right. That's a great statement. And again, you find it in a very similar way in the Proverbs 1 and verse 7. And in some passages in Deuteronomy as well. Key thing about this is that it had been said of Job in Job 1 verse 1, he feared God and turned away from evil. Everybody remember? Here it says that wisdom is the fear of the Lord and turning away from evil. Job is still maintaining his integrity, in other words, even here. And he is saying that his loyalty to God has been well placed, whether he understands how all this has happened to him or not. All right, now, Job 29 through 31, Job's final defense. We'll look at it next week. Everybody plan to be with us. Have a good week.